I think it would be inappropriate for me to delay you with anything in the way of a lengthy introduction to our speaker today, Professor Trevor Wilson. Very briefly, he has, of course, contributed enormously to the history of the First World War, is an authority in that area, and is best known, I guess, in some ways, by a wider readership anyway, for his revolutionary book, The Myriad Faces of War, published in 1986. And as is well known, this examined in a new way, from a vast range of sources, not only the battlefront, but the impact of the World War on all aspects of the British nation. So it was really a new insight, I suppose, into that idea of total war, in a way. He's published numerous other works, most of them more recently with his joint author, Robin Pryor, and some of you, I think, were present when his book on the Somme, their joint book on the Somme, was launched here in the Barsmith Library reading room by no less than the Premier of the State. So that was a very special occasion for us. This, I think, will be another very special occasion. Trevor has shifted his interest now to the Second World War. What I myself always find very stimulating in Trevor's work and conversations is his great focus on those two sort of strands of history, understanding the sources in their contemporary setting, but also, of course, looking at those sources and the events in the light of subsequent history. And this is what I think will be very hopefully stimulating in this talk today. So I'd like to welcome Trevor, who, of course, I was going to mention, he very modestly, very rarely mentions it himself, was always also awarded an AM in this year's honours for his work. So welcome, Trevor, and we're looking forward to hearing you speak to us on 1940 Britain, from phony war to finest hour to where.
The coming of the new year, the 1st of January 1940, was for Britain an uncharacteristic time. The large nations of Western Europe were at war with one another, as they had not been for the preceding 20 years. But by the same token, the 1st of January 1940 was quite unlike the 1st of January 1915 or 16 or 17 or 18. Being at war did not seem to mean the same thing anymore. In 1914, the day the war started was with a ferocious German invasion of neutral territory, first Belgium and then France. In 1939-40, on the other hand, the troops of France and Britain stood on their border, glaring across at the enemy standing on their border. But no actual conflict of significance was taking place between them. The boundaries remained the same as pre-war, and no massive fighting was taking place on them. The war had, of course, begun in September 1940 with the German invasion of Poland, a country whose territory was guaranteed by the British and the French, and the British and the French had responded by declaring war on Germany. But neither the French army, which was considerable, nor the British army, which was not, had moved from their positions to aid the Poles in any way. Poland was overrun within the month, and since then, no significant fighting on land had taken place. Now, as far as the French and the British were concerned, that was fine. They envisaged this war quite differently from how they had envisaged the war of 1914 to 18. In fact, their views about war had largely been marked by what they had undergone in 1914 to 18. For the French, standing on their border, employing the great defensive structure of the Maginot Line, which is a very powerful structure and has since been quite unjustly abused, and in the north, presenting an army which would immediately, that Belgium was attacked, move into Belgium and hold the Germans there. This was the strategy that they intended to carry out, to hold the enemy behind their own defences and let him destroy himself in the face of the withering guns that they could bring to bear. That view is even more so the view of the British. The British had particular views about how World War I had been won. The important thing to notice was that by the late 1930s, hardly anyone had respect for the British military command of the First World War. And hence the conclusion was drawn that the war had not been won on the battlefield by such an incompetent set of commanders. The war then had been won by the blockade. Germany had been defeated by being starved into submission, and that was what the British intended to do again. They immediately set in motion a blockade against Germany, and they waited for Germany to crumble before it. As Neville Chamberlain, at the time of the outbreak of the war, and until April, May 1940, Prime Minister of Britain, said memorably, particularly memorable because it was probably the last thing he said as Prime Minister, Hitler has missed the bus. It was to be quoted often, but not perhaps to his advantage. Hence, a sort of armed truce had settled upon Europe. Britain seemed almost tardy about pressing on with its military preparations. Its navy, of course, was spick and span. It was ruling the seas, and no one had better damn well challenge that. Military conscription had been instituted, it was true, back in April 1939, before the war had even begun, but as a means of trying to convince the Germans that Britain was serious. There would be no more appeasement. There would be no more concessions. If the British had to fight, then they would fight. But the assumption rather was that the warning would be enough. Pacifist agitation continued. Unemployment remained high. As for the evacuation of children from the big cities, where it was feared they would be subjected to terrible bombing, that had got underway as soon as the war started. 800,000 children without adults had been sent out into the country and with temporary parents. Half a million children, small children with their mothers, had gone into the country. But by early 1940, this was all breaking down. The bombers hadn't come. The kids were not particularly welcomed by the people who had received them, nor did the people who had received them feel very well towards the children. A lot of slum children from the cities imposed on the more quiet and orderly English countryside was a bad mix. By the beginning of 1940, 80% of these children had returned home. They were there in the cities again. In other ways, the war persisted to impose itself. Petrol rationing had been instituted, food rationing had been instituted, although neither of them with a severity which would become the case as the war proceeded. More potent and inconvenient was the blackout, which caused a high level of casualties among pedestrians and among motorists. H.L. Fisher, the noted historian, was one of the people who was killed by a car that got out of the way. Furthermore, the BBC was much changed. Britain, I think I'm correct in saying, was the first country to have a national television service. But the moment the war broke out, that was taken off the air. So were all the channels of the radio except one channel, the Home Service. But then after a while it woke up to people that you needed to provide something for the forces, and so they instituted a forces service. And that, before long, was the service that everyone was listening to. Dare I mention names like ITMAR and the Brains Trust to realise how influential the forces service was. That was the phony war, the Sitzkrieg, the Boer War, as I refer to it, B-O-R-E. This was the war in which there seemed to be not much fighting. And then in two dramatic actions by Germany and one by Britain, the world changed. On the 9th of April, German forces overran Denmark and invaded Norway. Now, the British had been nursing plans of their own towards Norway. They were fed up with the way that the Germans were getting iron ore from Sweden, bringing it round the Norwegian coast and into Germany. They thought that the way to counter this, which would be a violation of Norway's neutrality, but not too bad a one, was to sow mines in Norwegian territory, and that these would force the German vessels out into the open sea where the British fleet would be waiting for them. What the Germans intended when they invaded was something entirely different: the occupation of all of Norway by combined use of land forces, sea forces, and air forces, including, I think for the first time, paratroopers. War was changing a bit. That ran utterly contrary to the Allied conviction that the Germans couldn't invade Norway because Britannia ruled the waves. But however false to these preconceptions about who was boss where, by the 9th of April, the Germans had completely overrun Denmark and had established military control over many of Norway's major towns. The Allied response proved to be slow in coming, poorly equipped, and badly led. By the end of April, despite some successful naval action by the British, the Allies had been expelled from southern Norway and were fighting very hard to try and regain control of Narvik in the north. That setback led to the second major event, a violent upsurge in the British Parliament. Clear signs of what might happen had already been evident back in September 1939, on the day the war broke out. Neville Chamberlain on that day may just have been playing for time in order that the British and the French would declare war simultaneously. But to many backbenchers, his reason for playing for time might be something entirely different. He might be planning a second Munich. He might be planning to sell another ally down the river as a means of preserving peace. That certainly was the view of Leo Amery, a highly imperialistic conservative backbencher. Chamberlain made a statement which told what had happened, but gave no clue as to what the government was planning to do. As Arthur Greenwood, acting leader of the Labour Party, rose to reply to Chamberlain, Leo Amery called out, "Speak for England, Arthur," something which he clearly felt Chamberlain had not done. Well, now, on the 7th of May 1940, Amery was going to speak again, and in his own voice, he was going to speak for England. He was a poor orator who was well known for emptying the House of Commons. And anyway, he seemed to be speaking about dinner time, and most of the members were off in the cafes refreshing themselves for what was to come. But Clement Davies, one of the few liberals in the House of Commons, hurried out into the dining rooms and the corridors and said, "You've got to come in. Amery's going to say something important." So the House of Commons was well filled by the time Amery reached his rousing climax. using powerful words that Oliver Cromwell is supposed to have used, although I know there's some doubt about this, when he dismissed the Long Parliament. You have stayed here too long for any good you have been doing. Have done with it, I say, and get you gone. In the name of God, go. Amory was not alone. The government was also lambasted by a telling, if somewhat ambiguous, utterance of dismissal from David Lloyd George, paying back Neville Chamberlain for insults from long before. It was also castigated by Sir Roger Keyes, a man with a large, if I suspect scarcely justified, reputation from the First World War, where it was thought he had done heroic things at Gallipoli and at Zeebrugge. He again was a pretty dismal speaker, but he made up for it by wearing his full naval uniform in the House of Commons with all his decorations attached. Labour announced that it would treat the vote as a matter of confidence. Chamberlain, in reply, made an impassioned plea to his friends in the Commons, who, it's necessary to remember, included at this point Winston Churchill. Churchill had been out of office for the whole of the 1930s, a conservative backbencher at odds with his colleagues on many important issues. But with the start of the war, he had agreed to come back in the government as First Lord of the Admiralty. And it was Churchill who, if anyone, made a rousing defence of the government and its errors. Nevertheless, in the division, the government found its majority much reduced. It still secured 281 votes, which gave it a majority of something like 80. But it had been used to having a majority automatically of over 200. Clearly, the time for changes had arrived, particularly as 41 of the people who voted against the government were its supporters, allegedly. And a large number of other government supporters, though present in the House of Commons, had not voted at all. The time for a change was clearly near. And that was reinforced when the Labour Party, invited to join a coalition government, concluded that it would not join a government headed by Neville Chamberlain. The choice of successor, it is usual to say, lay between Churchill on the one hand, and Lord Halifax. Churchill, though he'd been Chancellor of the Exchequer in the Conservative government in the 1920s, had by the 1930s so fallen out with his colleagues that he did not play a part in any of the government of the 30s. It needs to be stressed that most people think that many of the reasons why he fell out with his colleagues were not to his credit. He was unlimited in his denunciations of Mahatma Gandhi and any move towards a policy of self-government for India. He was unqualified in his support for King Edward VIII, whose days as monarch of Britain nevertheless were few. But in the second half of the 1930s, Churchill had roundly condemned the policy of appeasement, which the government, and in particular Chamberlain and Halifax, were pursuing. Halifax, as a supporter of appeasement, was under a bit of a cloud, but he had strong support in the Conservative Party, who clearly felt that he was one of them in a way that Churchill was not. And so it is often represented that at this moment a great struggle for the leadership was taking place, and it could have gone either way. Now that, I think, is nonsense. And I would call to my support the diaries recently published of J.R. Colville, a young diplomat of moderate right-wing views who had been seconded to the post of private secretary to the Prime Minister, Neville Chamberlain. Late in April 1940, as Chamberlain's situation started to deteriorate, Colville wrote in his diary with concern about a difference of opinion between Chamberlain as Prime Minister and Churchill as First Lord of the Admiralty. That worried him because, as he wrote, the country thinks Churchill is the man of action and don't realise how harmful much of his energy is. The next day, he observed that the Churchill problem was still to the fore and that Chamberlain was wisely humouring Churchill, quote, whose position in the country is quite unjustifiably unassailable. The next day, with the fiasco in Norway quite evident, Colville observed that if Norway went seriously wrong, then a popular outcry might force the reconstitution of the government, and that Churchill, who was so much to blame for all that had gone wrong, would ride triumphantly forward on a wave of undeserved national popularity. Now, it's interesting to see the severe criticisms that Colville is making of Churchill, and yet the assumption on which he's acting, that if Churchill acts, he's Prime Minister, he's unassailable. There's no alternative to him. On the 10th of May, Colville and his friends are drinking champagne for the King over the water, who was not some obscure heir of King James II of England. They were drinking to the deposed Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain. Am I alone in thinking that all this talk about Halifax becoming Prime Minister because the King liked him and was prepared to try and persuade him to accept the chief office is just arrant nonsense? What we're viewing here is a change of British Prime Minister demanded by the nation at large, as Colville is virtually admitting, though he doesn't want it to happen, in a time of the most acute national danger. The politicians carried out what they had no choice but to carry out, to bring a new man to the top office who was not marked by the scandals of appeasement and who quite clearly, even in the issue of Norway, had wanted to get on and fight the war. What would have been the fate of a Halifax government if it had been formed? A Halifax government without Churchill wouldn't have lasted for 5 minutes, and a Halifax government with Churchill would rapidly have become a government in which a nominal Prime Minister bowed to the one strong man in its midst. It's interesting to note in this context one of the most popular books published in England in 1940. It was published in July 1940, and I own the 19th edition, which was published in August 1940. It was a book which had a good sale. It was called Guilty Men, and it denounces the men of guilt who had brought the British Army to the terrible peril of Dunkirk. And who are they? Chamberlain, Sir John Simon, Lord Halifax. These are the guilty men, the people who had not prepared the country for its coming turmoil. As Chamberlain later in the year remarked to Colville on the subject of persuading Halifax against his will that he should become the next British ambassador to America, Halifax has no future in this country, Churchill said. He will never live down his reputation for appeasement, which both he and the War Office have won for themselves. Anyway, Halifax, when offered the position by Chamberlain, said no. Churchill, on that same occasion, said nothing at all. That meant he got the job. The implications of this politically became evident on Churchill's early appearances in the House of Commons as Prime Minister. The Labour ranks cheered him to the echo. The Conservatives remained quietly and saved their cheers for Neville Chamberlain, who remained leader of the Conservative Party and actually remained a member of Churchill's government. It's odd seeing the Labour Party cheering Churchill in this way. After a few years as a social reformer before 1914, Chamberlain had moved very strikingly to the right, arguing for a big navy before 1914 and the Gallipoli operation, God help him, in 1915. By 1918, he had become so much of an anti-communist that he actually sent British troops to fight in Russia in the attempt to overthrow the Bolshevik regime there. Thereafter, he declared Labour a party unfit to govern. He played a major part in crushing the general strike of 1926. He praised Benito Mussolini, then Italian dictator, as a meritorious opponent of communism, and he condemned Mahatma Gandhi in terms which it is almost impossible to repeat. Indeed, it was, as I think I've said, his opposition to any talk in the Conservative Party about extending any sort of self-government to India that had begun his disassociation with the Conservatives. But in 1940, only one thing mattered as far as Labour was concerned: that throughout the second half of the 1930s, he had condemned Hitler uphill and down dale, had condemned German rearmament, had condemned German anti-Semitism. He had denounced the Munich settlement as a defeat without a battle. Now, in 1940, with the war going badly and set to go much worse, Churchill was prepared to take the actions which would place the entire population and economy under potential war direction, much to the praise of Clement Attlee, the leader of the Labour Party and now Deputy Prime Minister. There was another attraction of Churchill to the Labour Party. He was prepared to form a true coalition government. That didn't mean that Labour was getting anything near half the posts of ministerial rank, or that all the chief appeasers were getting the boot. But it did mean that most of the chief appeasers were sent to positions where they could do no harm. Sir John Simon became Lord Chancellor. Sir Samuel Hall was sent off to Madrid to represent the British position in Spain, and Lord Halifax, after a decent interval, was shunted off to Washington, where he was a considerable success. And Labour received some of the key posts in the government. Attlee, as deputy leader in the government, became, in effect, leader of the House of Commons because of Churchill's prolonged absences. Ernest Bevin, Britain's leading trade unionist, but not a member of either House of Parliament, entered the cabinet as Minister of Labour and was very rapidly moved into the war cabinet of just five or six people, and a seat in Parliament was in due course found for him. Herbert Morrison, leader of the London Labour Party, became Minister of Supply and then Minister of Home Security. He was one of the main people in creating the National Fire Service, which served the country so well during the terrible days of the Blitz later in 1940. While Labour and the Liberals welcomed Churchill, it took the Conservatives a while to reconcile themselves to this man who had done in their leader. Chamberlain remained a member of the government at Churchill's insistence, and he remained Conservative leader, as well as being the recipient of Conservative applause in the Parliament. until at least action by the British fleet against the Navy of France, which it was feared was about to fall into German hands, had the Conservatives cheering Churchill as well. Chamberlain in October 1940 was forced to resign from the cabinet as he was diagnosed fatally ill with cancer, and only then did Churchill become Conservative leader. He had been leader of the nation for many months by that time. Churchill had taken over at a grim time, as he bluntly informed first the cabinet, then the House of Commons, and then the nation. "I have nothing to offer you but blood, toil, tears, and sweat. Try that as a winner in any Australian election." And, of course, the situation was steadily getting worse. Even before the Norwegian campaign was completed, Hitler struck in the West. This was the third of our major events. On the 10th of May, the very day when Churchill became Prime Minister, German troops invaded Holland, Belgium, and Luxembourg. The Western Allies had long anticipated this move, and they believed that they were witnessing a rerun of the aggressive actions of Germany in 1914. That is, the Germans would not try to strike against the Maginot Line, which they recognised was not to be overcome. So they would strike north through Holland and Belgium, and so get round the Maginot Line and come southward against the French. The Germans had initially planned to do just that, but the decision to attack Belgium had been delayed by the exhaustion of the German forces in Poland and by the dreadful winter weather that they had suffered. And while time passed, Hitler changed his view. He was convinced by one of his tank commanders that it would be much better if they attacked in the north only as a diversion, that their main action would be elsewhere. And I think if you look at the map there, you'll see where I'm talking about. Notice that there are three German army groups there. There's Group B standing opposite Holland and Belgium with 29 divisions. And much to the south, opposite the Maginot Line, there is Group C with just 17 divisions. But in between them, facing no major opposition, facing Luxembourg and beyond that, the French district of the Ardennes, lies Army Group A with 45 divisions, including seven highly mechanised panzer divisions. This was not for the Germans going to be 1914 at all. The British and the French, confident they were fighting this rerun of 1914 Schlieffen Plan, moved promptly into Belgium, while on the extreme left, the French 7th Army, which had originally been allotted to stand behind the main army to act as a general reserve, instead was pushed far forward to come to the aid of the Dutch. The forces of the French left, that is, the French and the 10 British divisions, were among the pick of the military forces the Allies possessed anywhere on the Western Front. And they calculated that if they drove into the Germans, invading into Belgium and Holland, while the Maginot Line remained secure, then they had the enemy in a situation in which the Germans would simply dash themselves to pieces against strongly defending forces. Those calculations paid no attention to the whereabouts of Army Group A with its 45 divisions opposite the Ardennes. In the Ardennes, according to the French, nature had provided sufficient force, sufficient defence against any enemy intruder. that with its forests and its rivers and its valleys, an attacking force would be able to advance only at a snail's pace, and that if the Germans tried it, the French would have plenty of time to bring in strong forces to throw them back. That was a ludicrous miscalculation, but it meant that the French had in that area only meagre forces of advanced age and poor fighting quality and with ludicrously inadequate weaponry. It suffered the full onslaught of the 45 divisions of Group A, including the seven Panzer divisions. What the French got was blitzkrieg. This is your one really true example of a blitzkrieg battle. Blitzkrieg is not an air attack. Blitzkrieg is an army attack with air support, and the aeroplanes do just what the army wants it to do to soften up the area where the army is going to advance. The German infantry, the German bombers, especially their dive bombers, the German experts at bridging equipment, sped through the Ardennes as if nothing could stop them. They got across the River Meuse, which it was thought would be a major obstacle, in no time at all. They met up with what such force as the French could provide them at Sedan, scene of a terrible defeat of the French back in 1870. As for the British and French forces to their north, the further they advanced into Belgium, the more thoroughly they placed themselves in a trap between Army Group B coming straight at them and Army Group A going below them and then swinging up into their rear. Instead of dictating strategy, as the British and French thought they would be doing, they found themselves having to make desperate attempts to reposition themselves to meet the Germans. And the only consequence of these attempts was that wherever they got to, the Germans were there already. The Allies' dominant conclusion was that the Germans, having got through the Ardennes, having conquered Sedan, would then swing south to take Paris in their stride. But again, they miscalculated. The Germans, after breaking through the Ardennes and crashing the opponents at Sedan, headed directly to the sea. Thereby, they split their enemy forces in two. They then swung north, not south, forcing the British and French in the northern region deeper into the trap which the German A and B groups were forming for them. At this point, Lord Gort, the commander of the British Expeditionary Force, who had been conducting himself purely as the servant of French strategy and as the commander of an army on the ground, realised that he had certain responsibility towards his own army, and he reached a momentous decision. If his army was not to avoid death or captivity, it would have to leave the continent in a hurry. So he proposed to the British government that it should put its mind to the subject of evacuation. That caused no little amazement to Churchill's government, who up to that point had not recognised that the situation was quite that serious. But it was not the sort of amazement which caused it to disregard the proposal. The events by which the British army in France fell back on Dunkirk, the only point still available, and was, with great difficulty and great courage, spirited away to Britain, although without its tanks and without its heavy guns, and spirited away also 100,000 French soldiers, if they'd only taken, it must be admitted, at the last moment, but still a significant work of evacuation, generated rejoicing in a Britain which had much to be gloomy about. To the British people, it was a miraculous event of deliverance. Eventually, so enthusiastic did they become about Dunkirk that Churchill had to tell them wars are not won by evacuation. To the French, of course, it was not a cause for rejoicing at all. It was, to them, a quite usual act of British betrayal. The British had run out on their ally the moment the going got tough. Well, I think there's a lot to be said in favour of both these points, but it does seem to me that the collapse of France was plainly the result of other large things than the departure of the British from their what had become impossible situation. And if France fell apart with Britain's forces still trapped in the north, then the prospect of Britain's continuation of the war would be just that much more difficult. The onset of the French calamity clearly moves at this point from the military to the political field. As the Germans, now swinging south and heading for Paris, crash through the devoted but unsuccessful French military resistance on the Somme, the structure of France's wartime government was disintegrating. The overwhelming question was, what should France do now? Winston Churchill offered one answer, that however bad things got, the French and the British would become a single nation, operating, if need be, from southern France, or from the Pyrenees, or from North Africa, or, as a last resort, from across the Channel. But however the French held on, they would still be with the British at war with the Germans. Now, that wasn't just a British answer. It was the same answer as Georges Clemenceau, arguably the greatest Frenchman in 20th century French history, gave in 1918, when his army had been driven into hopeless retreat and Paris was threatened. "The Germans may take Paris," said Clemenceau. "Well, that will not prevent me from going on with the war. As for seeking peace, jamais, never." But the man who emerged to dominance in France at this crucial moment in 1940 was not another Clemenceau. Marshal Pétain certainly was remembered as a hero of the First World War, as the man who had rebuffed the Germans at Verdun and who had healed the French army following the terrible mutinies of 1917. But he was not a man of the French Revolution. He was not a man devoted to French anti-clericalism. He was not a devotee of liberty, equality, and fraternity. He loathed the democracy of the Third Republic. He embraced autocratic Catholicism as a system of belief, although heaven knows not as a system of action, if you see the number of ladies who shared his bed during these times. And he felt entirely at home when appointed as French ambassador in Madrid, because Spain had already undergone its right-wing revolution. It might be horrible for him to be confronting a situation in which the German army was triumphing over the French army, but it gave him a great opportunity to bring to an end the monstrosities of French liberalism, the horrors of what he regarded as elected neo-pacifist, Jew-dominated governments. If he conceded to the French the measure of victory that they demanded, he could establish a regime under his own doctrinaire direction, anti-Semitic, abolishing elections, establishing an education system which would give children little attention to reading or ideals and much attention to physical fitness and military activities. He would create a France in which duty consisted of obedience to authority, the authority of parents, the authority of the church, the authority of the state. Now, that line, of course, rejected any notion of an absentee French government keeping up France's resistance to Germany from Britain or North Africa. And even more significantly for the British, it placed the position of the powerful French fleet in a state of threatening ambiguity. Churchill and the British could do nothing about the decisions that the French government was making about its future course. But they could do something rapidly about the French fleet. Either it must place itself straight away out of the position where it could ever fight alongside the Germans, or it must be sunk. The British demanded that the French give such assurance. The French agreed that they would never place their navy in German hands, but that was a promise they might not well be in a position to abide by. In July 1940, the British sank the bulk of the French fleet. That great wartime alliance, which had been such a dominant feature of Europe from 1914 to 1918, and again from September 1940, was now well and truly at an end. Britain was one on its own. You may remember that famous cartoon of David Lowe, of the man standing there waving his fist and saying, "Very well, alone." It had two courses open to it. Hitler, contrary to the claim that is so often, did not offer the British any terms of negotiation. He simply told it, speaking, as he said, from the German position of a victor power, that Britain would be silly to go on fighting. That, I expect, held out to Britain the possibility of a retreat from war, but thereby also a policy of capitulation to a superior military force. It might have done so on terms which were more lenient than those being imposed on the French, but it would plainly be a large withdrawal from the position of independence and defiance that it had adopted when the Germans invaded Poland. Or it could opt for a continuation of war, which by any standards would be an unwelcome prospect and would be conducted in decidedly unfavourable circumstances. This is what makes it so important that Churchill got the job just on the eve of these things happening. Because of Churchill's position, there was, of course, no possible doubt. We shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender. But other words were being uttered. Lord Halifax was still foreign minister, still a member of Churchill's government. He was no Nazi sympathiser and he was no coward. But he could see no way in which Britain, without an ally, could win this war. And he saw terrible consequences for Britain if it remained in a state of unsupported conflict. What he wanted most of all was that the Anglican, rurified, socially delineated Britain of his youth would survive unhindered by these upheavals. And if it could only be accomplished by negotiations with Hitler, well, very well, they better negotiate. For a succession of days, late in May 1940, the British cabinet argued, or more accurately, agonised, over this issue. would they try to make terms with the Germans, or would they defy them? Churchill, of course, was firm, and so were the two Labour members of the War Cabinet. But also so was Chamberlain. He had been shockingly deceived by Hitler at the time of the Munich settlement. He was never going to make terms with that man again. Halifax, of course, could have resigned and sought to create an opposition which might become the government. Instead, he fell into line. So the war would go on. That passed the initiative back to the Germans. They could do one of three things. They could simply stop troubling the British any further, let them go along their silly ways, while Hitler reinforced his rule of Europe and extended it by the attack on the Soviet Union, which by the middle of 1914 he was beginning to plan. Alternatively, Germany could attempt to invade Britain, launching a great cross-channel military endeavour preceded by a sustained attack on the Royal Air Force and, from the air, on the British fleet. Or third, he could go along with a view that had prevailed for much of the 1920s and 1930s, after first being enunciated in 1918 by General Smuts, which is what led to the forming of the Royal Air Force, that victory in war no longer required armies except as a body for occupying an already conquered territory. A sustained attack from the air would devastate the munitions factory specifically and the British economy generally. It would destroy the homes and shatter the morale of the British population. Which would Hitler choose? Well, clearly he wasn't going to choose the first. He might be thinking of launching an attack on the Soviet Union, but that was all right. He could polish Britain off before then. He was not a man of small ambitions. Nor did he decide for the third of these courses, despite the widespread view that he did. He decided to create an army to cross the Channel and occupy Britain. Now, he did this in a very half and half way, with lots of qualifications in the way he spoke. But if you see what the man is doing, there is no doubt about what he was doing. He's creating an army in those ports of France from which the invasion is going to be launched. He's calling in the Rhine barges to transport the army across the Channel. God knows how they would have done, but as it happened, the matter wasn't put to the test. He would bring his navy into force to accompany the army across the Channel, and he would bring his airport to work to crush the Royal Air Force as a preparation for invasion. Hitler, without quite making up his mind, moved to this conclusion. At the end of July, he set about implementing it. The air assault on Britain, he instructed, would start immediately. If its results were not satisfactory, then preparations would cease. But, and I quote, "If we gain the impression that the English are being crushed and that the air war is, after a certain time, taking effect, then we shall attack." The date for the military invasion was placed for 15th of September. Now, all this shows that the six-week air attack on Britain from the middle of August was not intended as an independent bombing operation to defeat Britain from the air. It was intended as a distinct and planned preparation for an invasion. To quote Hitler again, "The German Air Force will use all available means to destroy the British Air Force as soon as possible. Attacks will be directed primarily against the flying units, ground organisation and supply institutions of the Royal Air Force, and further against the air armaments industry." Now, it may be that Goering, meanwhile, drawing wildly exaggerated conclusions about the effectiveness of the Luftwaffe in destroying units of the RAF, reached the elevated conclusion that an invasion would not be necessary because the air battle alone would destroy Britain. But there's no evidence that Hitler had reached that conclusion. In those opening weeks, he was waging war only against the RAF, not against British exports or British industry or the British people. On the 15th of August, after quite a delay on account of bad weather, Goering started the offensive, employing 801 bombers and 1,150 fighters. He encountered many setbacks. There were more British planes than he had allowed for, and their pilots were much more skillful and determined than he had calculated. But by the end of August, the Luftwaffe remained overall optimistic. Despite the fierce opposition of the British fighters, the Luftwaffe still considered that the RAF had been seriously damaged and its striking force considerably weakened. And it was reinforced in this by information from the German pilots themselves about the huge number of British planes that they were bringing down. That figure was, of course, much exaggerated, and it's true that pilots on both sides were exaggerating the number of the enemy that they were shooting down. There's a German aeroplane that was attacked by three British, or a British aeroplane attacked by three Germans, would be calculated as a loss to the enemy of three aeroplanes, not of one. And in that way, the figure went up and up and up. But the RAF didn't exaggerate the figures as badly as the Germans did. And what was more, they were working from a different base of calculation. The RAF had always exaggerated the size of the German Air Force when the war began. Hitler had told them, well in advance and well before it was true, that Germany had as many aircraft as Britain did. It never occurred to anyone that anyone would lie about having too many aeroplanes. Everyone would lie about having hardly any at all, but you'd never actually tell people you got more aeroplanes than you really did. The result was that the British began the war with an overestimate of the size of the opponent. So if they then overestimated the number they shot down, they were in fact getting the figure right, even by false calculations. The Germans, on the other hand, had from the beginning underestimated the number of British aeroplanes that they were going to have to encounter. They underestimated the output of the British factories that was producing more aeroplanes than the Germans were, not less, as the Germans assumed. And hence, when they overestimated the number of the British that they'd shot down, they were bringing upon themselves a serious miscalculation. Now, that's one possible explanation for the next stage of the Battle of Britain. On the 7th of September, completely unanticipated by the RAF, the British dispatched in daytime a huge air fleet, for which the RAF rose from their stations to meet, because they thought this was the ultimate attempt to obliterate the RAF. The result was that the British aeroplanes were nowhere near London when the Germans came to deliver this great daylight raid on the British capital. They set London ablaze when the Luftwaffe bombers came to follow up the attack at night. They had no difficulty finding the target. Arguably, that was a clear German indication that they saw victory in sight, and even believed that with a good hammering of the British capital, the British government might come to its senses, or at least that the British population might drive the government to their senses. But unfortunately, there's a thoroughly tenable explanation that is quite to the opposite of this, that already by the 7th of September, the German command recognised that the losses they were suffering at the hands of the RAF were too severe ever to facilitate a naval crossing of the Channel. Hence, it's a nice question as to whether we view 7th of September and the days that followed as a sign that Germany believed that victory was just round the corner, or they recognised that victory was going to be a long business and could not be achieved by an attack over the Channel in what increasingly would become the sort of weather where the Rhine barges would never remain on the surface. What strikes me as most evident is if the Germans did believe that they were getting near to victory, they were making a grievous miscalculation. There were still great battleships and hordes of destroyers that the British could call on to meet an invading army. And there were still air reserves which the Luftwaffe, far from defeating, had never really encountered. A point which is completely disregarded by the larger body of people who like to write about the Battle of Britain as if it was a case of the British hanging on by their fingertips. At least in one sense, it may be the case, as Churchill said, that never in the field of human conflict has so much been owed by so many to so few. But it needs to be noted that the few who fought the Battle of Britain were not the entire British Air Force. The few were only that sector of the RAF situated in the southeast section of Britain, Sector 11, commanded by the New Zealand-born Air Vice Marshal Sir Keith Park under the direction of Dowding. Sometimes, although not all that often, they were assisted by Lee Mallory's Sector 12, which was situated somewhat to the north. But only once, when the Germans launched a supremely futile attack from Scandinavia against the Midlands without fighter support, causing the enemy to lose large numbers of aircraft, was the enemy engaged directly against sectors 12 and 13. As for sector 10, guarding the southwest of Britain, it was never involved in the serious fighting. What all this meant was that 4/5 of the RAF, far from losing heavily, were for much of the battle not involved in conflict at all. If Sector 11 suffered such heavy losses that reserves had to be called on, there were sectors 10, 12, 13 ready at hand. So unlikely was it that Britain could be defeated by this matter. As it happened, sufficient planes and even sufficient replacement pilots were brought into Group 11 to keep it flying and fighting. The notion that Britain's success in the Battle of Britain was a close-run thing, I really don't think can stand up to purchase. What followed from the middle of September was the Blitz. On the 15th of September, Hitler decided to postpone the invasion of Britain indefinitely, and the German invasion force, having been much troubled by RAF bombers, dispersed quietly. The Blitz which followed was, for the population of Britain, of course, the worst time of the war. A German attack against their cities, against their homes, against their industries. Until nearly May 1941, the British lacked the sophistication of flying skills at night, and the radar perception and the bending of beams which would enable them to cope with a bomber force coming at them in the dark. They did, of course, present anti-aircraft guns, which made a lot of noise and gave great comfort to the population, but never actually hit anything. So London was bombed every night but one for a succession of 56 nights. So Coventry in November 1940 was subject to atrocious devastation. So the major ports and industrial centres of Britain suffered severely, not least because their local authorities had refused to take notice of the lessons which London could teach them. This was the period when John Strachia, Labour MP, who once but no longer had placed great faith in the foreign policy of the Soviet Union, went out searching for survivors of the air raids, digging for Mrs. Miller. These were horrible times for the British people who lived within the area of bombing, and they've been the subject of powerful memoirs and semi-fiction works. But viewing the war on a wide scale, it was clear that Britain had passed the stage where the subjection of this country to Nazism was any longer on the agenda. The Germans had all along planned their air force as an element in a combined military operation, not as a unit to carry out the Blitz, if we mean by the Blitz the attempt to subdue Britain by air power alone. Their air force had always been planned as a support to their army on the ground, that the air force would pulverise the areas into which the army was going to move. The air force that could cripple Britain by sheer weight of bombs did not exist. It just wasn't there, and it never was there. The Germans never built that sort of aircraft. Always their aircraft was built to help their troops on the ground. Of course, by the end of the war, it was built simply to ward off the bombing attacks of other countries. It was only the British and then the Americans who set out to create an air force which they believed could do real damage to the enemy, because as far as the British was concerned, that was the only sort of damage they could do to the enemy for most of the war. Certainly, large parts of Britain were bombed, but large parts, of course, were never bombed, and not many parts of Britain were bombed continuously, constantly, suffering the sort of devastation from which there could be no recovery. The attacks destroyed many historic buildings and rendered a considerable body of people homeless. But it killed relatively few, actually. This period of the air war kills 43,000 Britons. Now, that's a lot. But if you think of it as a proportion of the British population, of course, it's nowhere. And when you can remember that a lot of the people who was killed were children or were old people, well, I mean, that's awful. But it's much better, in fact, to have a range of the population killed than to just concentrate death among that group of the physically young and fit that were wiped out in the First World War. The output of factories producing war materials continued with only minor interruptions. The damage to power supplies was real, but it was made good relatively quickly. Coventry, as we all know, suffered an atrocious air raid in November 1940 with 450 enemy aircraft, destroying the old city and the magnificent 14th century cathedral. Yet only 554 people were killed, which is practically one per aircraft. And the aircraft factories on the outskirts of the city of Coventry were not damaged at all. In other words, the Coventry air raid, which was such a shock to British morale, in terms of reducing Britain's fighting power, achieved practically nothing at all. London, though severely scarred, was, according to its expert, continuing to fulfil the main functions of a great metropolis. The government remained in London. The organs of administration continued to function there. J.B. Priestley wrote of London life at the time, "As a kind of civilian life, this is hell. But as battles go, it's not at all bad." So by the end of 1940, the situation had developed far from that of the 1st of January. Britain had lost all its allies, particularly France, and it was itself suffering heavy and continuing damage. Yet with the aid of geography, its pre-war preparations of an air force, and the steadfast resistance of its population, it had rendered an invasion impossible. And at whatever price to its long-term economic viability, it was about to receive vast amounts of war material from the United States under the just adopted policy of Lend-Lease. So who was the winner? Churchill had written, "Hitler knows that he must defeat us in these irons or else lose the war." Well, Hitler had not defeated the British in their islands. But from Hitler's point of view, the war was anything but lost.